Fugitive. A QM production. Starring David Janssen as Dr. Richard Kimball, an innocent victim of blind justice, falsely convicted for the murder of his wife.
Talking Fugitive with the usual suspects, Bobby Neer and Kitty and Ken. And if you want to join in the discussion, you can also talk Fugitive at 800-407-5728 or email talk at ksav.org. All right, who is going to start off this week?
Me.
All right, go right ahead.
All righty. Richard Kimball has very few options in his quest to convince the world that he is innocent of murder. Those options are that he can either find the one-armed man, or he can try to get a new trial by coming up with some sort of new evidence, or he can find a witness to the real crime. In the past couple of shows, the two shows we did prior to today, we did Search in a Windy City from Season 1, and that one dealt with Kimball's ability to find the one-armed man, drag him back, and I suppose get him to confess, although I've never been convinced that that's actually possible. Now, as we begin Season 2, we have an episode called Man in a Chariot, which deals with the possibility that Kimball might find a lawyer who might want to make a name for himself, or might have a new idea, or might have gone through the transcript of the old trial, found something that isn't right, something that can get Kimball a new chance at a new trial. This episode leads off Season 2, and it is generally highly regarded as a classic episode. I went back and looked at our Season 2 book, and I see that I gave it an 8.5, although I did have a lot of problems with it, which I put in my review. And Kitty gave it an 8, and she agreed with me that about the problems. And Ken didn't much like it at all. He gave it a 5, so we'll let him speak in a little while and explain why. The premise is that Kimball begins the story working as a dishwasher again, a job that he must be very good at by now. And he goes out in the bar or the restaurant, wherever he's working there. And on the TV is a famous lawyer named G. Stanley Laser, who is being interviewed, and he lists the several famous criminals and claims that he could have gotten them off. The jury would have found them innocent had he been running the defense. Kimball's name is in the list, so of course he takes note of that and watches for a while. And one thing leads to another, and before you know it, Kimball's got a meeting with Laser and his secretary, his longtime secretary, and they make a deal. Laser, who was once a famous criminal attorney, but apparently was in some sort of accident which caused him to lose his ability to be in the courtroom. I don't quite understand this, because he's in a wheelchair, but he can walk. He gets out of it sometimes for a few seconds, and he scoots around on his chair that has wheels on it. So I don't quite understand why it is he had to give up his career as a lawyer. I don't see. He's become a professor. He's working at a college in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and I don't see where he's doing anything teaching these law students that he wouldn't have been doing in a courtroom anyway. But at any rate, he's had to give up that. And he tells Kimball that he agrees to look at the transcript of the trial and sees a lot of problems there and determines that he could have gotten them off. Now, it's a lot to ask Richard Kimball to simply turn himself in, especially because, as far as I know, you can get a new trial unless you come up with new evidence. So Laser is going to run a mock trial with his law students, but I'm never quite sure exactly what he intends to accomplish by that. I'm not a lawyer, but I've watched enough TV shows and real-life crime stories and trials on TV to believe that you cannot get a new trial unless there's a specific reason. Now, we discussed the trial scenes in The Girl from Little Egypt at some length in several other shows in the past, and the problems we had with the trial, but none of them really come up here. But my question to you, Kitty, is Richard Kimball, is this really a good deal for him? Should he really be taking a chance like this, given the fact that there's no guarantee there'll be any return on it at all?
Well, I think it's a good gamble for him because he doesn't, I mean, he's got so few options at this point. And one of the things that I remember that's brought up in this is that when he first sees the mock trial starting, and he asks Laser why he's having his students do this mock trial, he said something to the effect of, what better way to find out if you've got a shot at getting an acquittal than by doing it here? You know, it was kind of like, let's see what we can do here before we actually try doing it for real. And I actually liked how this started because I thought we were actually going to see a show that really kind of explained why Richard Kimble got convicted in the first place. And, you know, not only was he convicted, but he was convicted of premeditated murder when, by all accounts, from what's said, you would think that the worst he would have been convicted of would have been, like, second-degree murder or manslaughter, because he just doesn't seem like, you know, from everything we've heard up to this point, it just doesn't seem like he has any real big motive to premeditate his wife's murder. And so I thought maybe we were going to see some of that here. But unfortunately, you know, as with many episodes in this series, the writers seem to start off with a fairly good concept, and then they just kind of take the easy way out. Because the trial, as we know, it goes on, and it becomes more about Stanley Laser than about Richard Kimble and why he was convicted.
Ken?
Yes, I agree. I don't know why you two guys like this episode.
I don't like it all that much. Don't pay too much attention to that number.
I did read your review today in our book.
I had problems, yeah, and I said so.
It was a very good review. You really laid out
Thanks.
The whole story. And my problem with it is it's the first episode of season two. Now, season one ended with the end game, and that must have been about in May of 1964, right?
Right.
So we have all summer to wait
right.
to see what season two is going to bring us. So in September of 64, they're promoting the new season of The Fugitive. And here, the first episode is Man in a Chariot, and we see this grumpy old man, Ed Begley, who plays Laser. I guess he's a defense attorney, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And then one of his bright students, Gould, is the prosecutor.
Right.
And both of these guys didn't prove their case at all to me in this trial. And you have all these students who are, you know, they're in a class. I would give this class, or actually this mock trial, an F. I mean, what was proven? I mean, Laser didn't prove that Kimble didn't do it. I mean, we still don't know. And then Gould, you know, all he brings up is, I guess, some drinking, and they were mad at each other and shouting. But what evidence does he have that Kimble killed his wife?
Well, let's go back to the beginning before we get to that point. That is, like I just said a few minutes ago, what is going to come? I'm not clear exactly on what comes of this. So let's just say that it didn't turn out the way we know it turned out. And they did look at all the evidence, and they decided, well, like we did when we saw the flashback scenes in The Girl from Little Egypt, that was an outrageous trial, and all kinds of rules were broken. What do you do now? As far as I know, you cannot request a new trial unless there's a specific reason. There's got to be some sort of evidence that you found since the trial in order to get... Who is going to get this new trial?
Well, on the other hand, though, keep something else in mind, is that you can also get... I believe you can also get new trials if the defense can show that something was not followed properly
right.
in the first trial. And certainly, if it's in the transcripts that the jurors are whispering to each other during the middle of the trial, I think that would be grounds right there to have that declared a mistrial and to be granted a new trial.
Okay,
I mean, because obviously procedure was not being followed correctly.
Yeah, but
there's
only one problem with that, and you get that in season three when we get to trial by fire, the possible trial because they found a witness, and that is the fact that Kimball cannot stay a wanted man if there's going to be a new trial. He's got to turn himself in. You can't just say, okay, I'll take the new trial and I'll hide out and see how it comes out, and then I'll decide whether I want to turn myself. He's got to turn himself in first.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, that the risk is unbelievable. So let's just say that they have the mock trial and they do what we did when we took apart the girl from Little Egypt and say, this is ridiculous. The prosecutor was outrageous. The jury discussed the case while they were right in the courtroom. All kinds of things were done wrong. Kimball was misrepresented. His lawyer sat there like he was dead. He said nothing.
Right.
All these things are reasons, but at this late date, I don't know that any of that is really compelling enough. The real problem with this, well, you know what I'm going to say? I'm going to say the same thing I've been saying for years, which is that the writers can't go through with it because there is no case against Richard Kimball. That's the problem. There is simply no case against him at all. And the fact that he got convicted is ridiculous to begin with. You know, Roy Huggins wrote this great series, but he didn't dot every I and cross every T. He never thought that anybody would really care how it came to be. Because he started the story in the middle by simply saying, don't worry about the trial, and don't worry about what happened. Just believe what I tell you, because it's not about that. It's about being on the run and trying to find the man who did it. That's all it's really about. We, however, want to see more than that. I don't know the audiences back in the 60s wanted to see that, but now we do because we're more sophisticated
yeah.
now. And we see things on TV that show everything. All of the autopsies and the investigation and the trial and everything. Law and Order has been on for like 15 years. And so people now figure that it's our birthright. We're going to be told everything. Back in the mid-60s, somebody really cared. We just wanted to be entertained. We didn't really give a damn one way or the other.
But, you know, by the same token, though, I mean, I would think that Stanley Laser would have a shot at getting Richard Kimball off because Stanley Laser does not come across to me as a defense attorney who would sit there like a deaf mute and would not, you know, stand up and make his objections to, you know, to what's going on in the courtroom. And you got to remember, too, that the burden of proof is on the prosecution. And, you know, if what we are supposed to accept from Girl from Little Egypt is that his defense attorney sat there like a deaf mute and just really did nothing to defend Richard Kimball, well, then you might be able to make an argument that the jury came up with the only evidence, with the only conclusive verdict they could, because there was no defense, basically, for Richard Kimball. On the other hand, Stanley Laser is not the kind of guy who's just going to sit there. I mean, the burden of proof is on the prosecution, and he really comes across to me like a guy who could put holes into into the prosecution's case.
But I want to ask Ken something, and that is this episode points something else up too that we don't often discuss. Doesn't anybody wonder what happened after the original Kimball trial? Were there any appeals about anything? Were they turned down? What happened? Because even back in the 60s, it still took about 10 to 15 years for anybody to be executed.
Well, I was just going to say, I remember in the very, very first episode, Fear in a Desert City, he told Monica that he had, like, close to 2 years of appeals before they were taking him off to death row.
And he also told Wilmer Springer that he had a fair trial.
Sure.
So
obviously, Kimball had never been in a courtroom before,
right.
So he didn't know any better.
Question I would ask Richard Kimball is, you had a fair trial? What about fingerprints? What about, anyone who saw the one-armed man run outside the house? You know, that was the craziest thing, really, to ever happen, if you're the one-armed man, right?
You could have run an entire season doing that. As a matter of fact, when you get to season four and they've run out of stories, they should have gone back and done that.
Right.
I mean, they had nothing else to do. He'd escaped
right.
every way imaginable. So why not go back? And, you know, we've talked about the lack of flashbacks and the lack of a backstory, and simply done that. In other words, they've got several stories. They do The Girl from Little Egypt, they do this one with Laser, and they do Trial by Fire. They should have combined them all, actually, into a multi-part story, like a four-part arcs of some kind, that in which we deal with this issue about the trial, was it fair, wasn't it fair. It would have been more compelling. Instead, they break it all up into individual stories.
Oh.
And I'm still going to say that I don't understand why Laser had to give up being a lawyer. I don't see where he's so disabled that he can't do that.
Okay, we're going to take a quick time out. I'm sure that we'll find out why Laser had to give up, because Ken will tell us when we come back on the other side of this Talkin' Fugitive here on Retro Radio.
Hear the music you love from the past. All the memories you cherish will last. Listen and you'll agree, it's the place you wanna be. It's KSAV. Never far away, at work or at play. Hear the sounds that you love every day. We play the sounds of today and yesterday, so stay with KSAV. Whether on the go or in your home, you'll hear songs of yesterday. KSAV will be with you to warm the day in every way. So share the music of KSAV. Listen to us, we know you'll agree. It's the place you want to be for songs that fill the day. It's KSAV. Stay with KSAV.
Find out why Laser had to give up being a lawyer and what his disability was, and for the answers to that, let's go back to the three experts here.
Okay, well, we'll get to that in a minute. I just want to say that when we come back 2 weeks from tonight, we'll be on the second episode of Season 2, and it's been a very long time since Richard Kimball had any female companionship, all the way back in Episodes 4 and 5 with Karen. He's running around the country, but there's been a couple of flirtatious moments, but nothing real. And then all of a sudden, in episode number 32 of the series, he meets, before Bob Newhart meets her, he meets Suzanne Pleshette, an absolutely gorgeous Suzanne Pleshette, by the way, in an episode called World's End. And Kimball, well, we'll save it for then. Let's just say that he rekindles an affair or some interest in her that he once had. Not only on screen, as it turns out, but also off screen. And speaking of Suzanne Pleshette, and her, she was in two episodes of the series. She was married to Tom Poston. For those people old enough to remember Tom Poston, who was in, I believe, the second Bob Newhart show. He died today. He was 85 years old. And Suzanne Pleshette also had lung cancer surgery last year. I don't know how she's doing on that, but she'll be. We'll be discussing World's End when we come back 2 weeks from tonight. The real problem with this episode isn't really so much Laser or how he feels or his need to be loved again in the world, but the fact that they go ahead and have this mock trial. And for those of us who absolutely despise the trial scenes in The Girl from Little Egypt, like me, we have some real hope for a minute there. We think to ourselves, okay, so here are some college students who are supposed to be very bright. Here's this famous lawyer who's become a professor. And they're going to take the case apart piece by piece, and we're going to question all the things that got done wrong. I mean, I thought that was the whole reason for this episode to exist in the first place. Instead, all we get is a couple of scenes. It's really not much. I mean, a lot of time is wasted. And the first thing they deal with is Helen Kimball and how many martinis she had the night of the crime. Did she really have six or five or four or whatever? And I say, I really don't care. I don't know that has anything to do with the crime. If a one-armed man came into the house, or even if Kimball killed her, didn't matter whether she was drunk or she wasn't drunk. What's going to happen one way or the other? So I don't know why they're wasting time on that at all. Then they have another short discussion about whether or not the killer, whether it's Kimball or whoever, or if there was a one-armed man, could a one-armed man actually kill a woman with one hand. Unfortunately, they don't take one. The bigger problem that we have is that they still haven't decided whether she got strangled or she got hit over the head with a lamp. Because if you hit her over the head with a lamp, you only need one hand. And if you're strangling her, well, you might need two. What do you think, Kitty?
Well, you know, obviously you do need two hands, and in theory, although didn't we see the actor who plays the one-armed man, Bill Raisch is his name?
Yeah.
Didn't we see him in a movie start to strangle somebody with the sleeve on his shirt? I could have sworn I saw a clip of him in some old movie where he came up to somebody, took the sleeve on the arm where...
He did the parts in movies. He was in a movie with Kirk Douglas. That may be the...
And he just wrapped that sleeve around one guy's neck and started to pull.
Yeah, and in the trial they even mentioned the fact that a person with a disability like that who has one arm would naturally, over a period of time, develop more strength in one arm to compensate for the lack of the other one.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that it's impossible, but we haven't yet decided exactly how she was killed anyway.
And I don't know, did they actually say in that trial that she was strangled, or did they just pretty much talk about her death and how many
they just talk about her being drunk, and Kimmel supposedly said something. I mean, they don't discuss that. There are several things in the trial that we... And this is the lack of consistency thing, again, that we're always talking about. They don't even talk about some of the things they saw that we saw in the trial, such as the next-door neighbor who heard them arguing and therefore deduced from that there was some sort of violence going on. Things like that, I mean, they don't even deal with that. So I'm right away very disappointed, and that was the big disappointment for me in this episode, that I wanted them to take it apart piece by piece. Ken, you only gave it a 5. I gave it 8.5 based on the acting alone. I mean, that's what did it for me. But I think I agree with a lot that you said. Why only a 5?
The actors were good. Bagley was good. The guy who played Gould, what was his name?
His real name?
Yeah. I didn't.
Robert Drivers.
Yeah, I thought he was good.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, the trial really, really disappointed me. Obviously, you know, at the end of the episode, they say Kimball's innocent, and that was so flat. But I tell you, there were parts of the episode I did like, and that's why I gave it a 5. If I don't like it, I give it a 1 or a 0.
Right.
But the part I liked was Gould. Gould was a interesting character to me. He was smart, sharp. You know, it turns out he helps Kimball, you know, he sees the camera, warns Kimball. But you know the part I liked the best? Remember when Gould and Kimball sat down in the restaurant?
Right.
And, you know, he wants to give it up. He's mad at Laser for, you know, scolding him in the courtroom. You know, Laser was out of line in the courtroom.
Right.
But when they were talking, and I was saying, you know what? Gould and Kimball, you know, that would have been a good team. I think Gould would have been a good defense attorney for Kimball.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe he's smart enough, you know, to ask some questions, you know, maybe some CSI work, you know, fingerprints.
That's the whole point. That would have made a better episode.
Yeah.
This young, up-and-coming lawyer, let's just say he's just out of law school, and he wants to make a name for himself, and he seizes upon this case, maybe had some interest in it earlier. And he decides that he's going to take Kimball on. He's not that well known. That would have made a better story, because then we would have dispensed with all this nonsense about this cranky old man who had to be loved again.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, because, you know, initially they give you the impression that you're actually going to see a fair amount of this trial, when in actuality, in the final analysis, you're seeing Kimball counseling Gould, telling him not to give up law school, and then you're seeing Stanley Lazar coming to terms with his inner demons, and, you know, and of course in the final analysis, when the jury renders its verdict of not guilty, I'm sitting here going, why did they find Kimball not guilty?
Yeah.
What was it that Lazar said that was so compelling? And of course in the end, Lazar tells Kimball that the jury found me not guilty.
Yeah. I thought the police angle to the story was very, very lame and weak.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know what? do away with that. You don't need the police kind of snooping around and kind of add some suspense.
Except that Kimball's escape is innovative in this series.
Oh, you mean up at the
climbing the ladder, because nobody tries to go vertical until the last episode of the series.
Boy, we got,
and the one-armed man goes vertical and doesn't make it. So you know.
This is another example of very smart policemen, right?
Yeah.
You know, they don't check everybody out. They just assume that guy's a student at the top of the ladder.
I think this episode would have benefited by having Barry Morrison in. I think Gerard should have been in this. Of course, if they were really going to do a serious trial episode, they would have had a two-part story.
Oh, and it could have been interesting to actually have put Lieutenant Gerard on the stand to be cross-examined by both the defense and the prosecution.
Well, here's the part that, since Ken said the part he really liked, I think the part I really hated, and that's at the end of the story where Laser, this is in the epilogue, where Laser says to Kimball, you don't really want to go through with this now because you have to realize that verdict was for me. It had nothing to do with you. I mean, don't you think Kimball should have actually committed a crime right there and killed him on the spot? Because he had him, I mean, he hung around, he looked through the back door of the courtroom. He put himself in extreme danger because this lawyer, just an hour before, had said, oh yeah, I think I can really get off this, there's something here. And then at the end of it, when he gets what he wants, which is respect out of his students and to feel whole again, then he simply says to Kimball, well, I know you got acquitted, but I hate to tell you this, it really didn't have a damn thing to do with you, it had everything to do with me. I just thought it was absolutely outrageous. I really wanted to kill him at that point. I thought, what a horrible thing to do to this man. Not only did you give him hope for nothing, but you put his life in danger. He had to climb a ladder in the law library in order to get away, and now you arrogantly sit there and say, I got what I want out of it, but look, if you want to turn yourself in, which is a joke, and go to trial, we'll present what? They didn't come up with a single piece of new evidence.
Nah.
They came up with absolutely nothing
at
all.
And they didn't really even discredit any of the evidence that the prosecution had, although the prosecution didn't really say that much when you get right down to it either.
You know, I was looking at Ed Robertson's book, The Fugitive Recaptured, before we got on the show tonight, and Alan Armour, who was one of the producers of the show back then, called this one just about his favorite episode of the series, and said that, the show won an Emmy Award at the end of the 65-66 season.
Okay, 1 minute.
That's the third season. And that the Emmy committee wanted them to send a test episode to them for everybody to look at, so they sent this one.
Oh, wow.
But I don't understand that. I didn't know, since maybe they did it this way back in the 60s. Well, if the show is up for an Emmy Award for 65-66, the third season, why would you be able to send them an episode that began the second season? What does that have to do with it? Maybe that's the way they did it then. I don't know.
They should have sent them Escape into Black.
Oh, come on. Escape into Black. You mean to tell me they won the Emmy Award for Best Dramatic Series in the third season, which I think was highly deserved. Anybody ever hear of Landscape with Running Figures?
Yeah.
How about sending that one? I mean, they went back and sent this one. I think they were just overwhelmed by the acting. They were thrilled to have Ed Begley, a very famous actor, in it.
Yeah.
And they got carried away with that when that was not really a good enough story. I can only justify my rating by the acting. The acting is extremely good. But other than that, it's a weak episode, and it doesn't give
it
what
we're kept my interest, you know. I rank it number 25, maybe.
Yeah.
All right, out of the top 24. Okay, well, thank you for another good job. You'll be back in 2 weeks to talk some more of the greatest drama in television history. The rest of you, stick around. In about 1 hour, talking television with Dave White. It's going to have Anthony Wynn and Robert Wood to talk about Barry Morris's book, Remember with Advantages. All right, see you in 2 weeks, folks, here on Sheravision Radio.